Hey, so this is the second episode of the Institutional Design Podcast. Still very much in the experimental stage, but I felt really good about the last episode. And yeah, this one I also am quite excited about. My guest today is Rupert Freeman. Rupert Freeman is an assistant professor of business administration in the quantitative analysis area at the University of Virginia's Darden School of Business. He received his PhD from Duke University in 2018 and spent 2 years as a postdoctoral researcher at Microsoft Research, New York City. His research focuses on the intersection of artificial intelligence, operations research, and economics, particularly in topics such as resource allocation, voting, and information elicitation. Rupert actually has a bunch of cool research that I think is relevant to the institutional design theme of this podcast. But today we're going to be talking about forecasting competitions and prediction markets and some of the incentive issues that pop up with those institutions. Hey, Rupert, thank you so much for coming on and talking to me.
Yeah, thanks a lot, Nick. It's great to be here. Thanks for the invite.
Excellent. So I guess to get us started and set the scene for the two papers that we'll be talking about, laying some background. What's the idea behind crowdsourced forecasting? Why would we want to ask people to give probabilistic forecasts? Where has this been used before and what have the results been? Why should we care about this topic?
Yeah, that's a great question, Nick. And I think hopefully people don't need too much convincing that probabilistic forecasting is important from our day-to-day lives, to every decision we make, up to business decisions, up to political decisions on national global scales. And to make good decisions, we need good information and good predictions. So I think that's pretty clear. And then maybe the main part of your question is, why would we want to crowdsource that information? And I think this is one of the coolest phenomena that exists, which is that in this wisdom of crowds phenomenon, the idea that the average or some aggregate of a group of predictions, even kind of lay people predictions, can be as good or even better than expert predictions. And this was first observed in the early 1900s by this guy, Francis Galton, who was asking a crowd to measure the weight of a bull or to guess the weight of a bull. And it's really just been observed time and time again since then. There's a book, The Wisdom of Crowds. There's lots and lots of information online about this, and it just persists.
One question people might have is, how can you tell if a probabilistic prediction is, if you ask me, will it rain tomorrow, and I give you a number between 0 and 1, so I say it's 80%, and then it rains, like, was I right or was I wrong? And was someone else who said 90%, were they more right? And how much more right? And how do we figure out that?
Yeah, exactly. So it's a great example. And actually, the kind of theory around this stuff is interesting. You use the weather example because this originated from the 1950s, actually by someone who was interested in weather reports, Glenn Bryant. And he had exactly this question, right? It's very hard to say that whether a probabilistic forecast was right or wrong. And it's actually impossible, as you get to. If it's 70% chance of rain, then it rains, or it doesn't rain. Even a 70% report allows for 3 in 10 chances of it not raining. So right or wrong is very hard. I think when we get to the question of, is one report better than another, that's where maybe we can start making some progress. And even then, it's very hard. But what we can do is we can use these things called scoring rules. And what a scoring rule does is it literally gives a score based on the prediction and based on the binary realization, or so the output, whether it rained or not. And the idea here is that if it does rain, then maybe an 80% prediction should get a higher score than a 70% prediction, because it was in some sense more right.
And at the same time, if it doesn't rain, get a worse penalty. So you can't just always extremize and say 100%.
Exactly. And actually, you can design these things so that you can always, it's always the case that reporting the belief that you actually hold will maximize your score in expectation. So of course, your score is still subject to some randomness, some uncertainty about whether it does indeed rain or not. But there's no way to just universally get a higher score. If you go from 70 to 80, sure, you'll do better if it does rain, but you're going to get a lower score if it doesn't. And that's exactly the trade-off that these scores are getting at. In expectation, the best reports will get the highest scores.
Excellent. And also just an interesting thing to clarify is that, so we're interested in asking forecasters for probabilistic scores, but just to keep in mind, audience, we don't necessarily need to just take what the forecasters say and just report that. We can, after we receive the forecast, we could put in that to whatever kind of fancy machine learning algorithm or statistical process we like to maybe improve the results of just taking the average or the median. But as you said, we still want forecasters to report their accurate beliefs, which we can then statistically process.
Absolutely.
So now that we know what proper scoring rules are, it seems like we've solved the problem. So we just ask forecasters to report their forecasts. We score them and then turn that score into a monetary incentive or just a point system and just give them that. And excellent. This podcast has only been about 10 minutes. So yeah, this we'll call it a day.
Yeah, you would think so. And when you hear about these things, it sounds like this is a magic bullet done. And we're all sorted. It's funny, I actually, maybe you or someone else will correct me one day, but I actually don't know of any real life implementations that literally implement scoring rules, that just pay, at least none of the crowdsource setting at least, where you just pay a whole lot of people their individual score. And as far as I can tell, the reason that this happens is fundamentally because scoring rules are not very good at discriminating between forecasters or at rewarding good forecasters. So it just as one example, if you take Breyer's original quadratic score, this one that he designed in the 50s, and you take the most standard version of that in terms of the way we normalize it, if you just report a 50-50 prediction, so even if you have no actual knowledge, you can just come to the system and say, well, I think there's a 50% chance of rain, and you are guaranteed a payoff of 75 cents if we're scaling our payments to be between $0 and $1. Whereas if you come to the system and you are some omniscient weather forecaster and for sure that it rains tomorrow, your information is much more valuable. But you only get paid a dollar. So that's only 33% more than someone who potentially has no information. So that fundamentally drives, I think, a difficulty with implementing these things in practice. So if you think about it, if you're a principal, you're someone who wants to pay for information. If you have $100 to spend, what are you going to do with that? You could go and ask 100 different people for their prediction, but you're going to potentially pay for a lot of noise, right? A lot of garbage. And the good predictions won't actually get rewarded very well. If you want to ask more than 100 people, then you're going to have to pay each forecaster a very small amount to stick within your budget. So it just doesn't work out that well to individually pay so many people without really discriminating how much you pay them. So what we tend to see instead are these setups that are more competitive in nature. So I guess that's what we're going to talk about today, where the design is more such that the pool of money that might go to one person, or maybe forecasters can directly win money from other forecasters and essentially help us discriminate between good and bad.
Kind of like the difference in if we were organizers of a race, instead of paying people a number based on how fast they run around the track, we pay them based on their place relative to other people. So it's like, it's zero sum. Your score is dependent both on how well you do in an absolute sense and how well you do relative to the other participants.
Yeah, that's an analogy I hadn't heard before, but I love it. If you take, you know, an Olympic 400 meter runner and they're running this track in, what is, 42 seconds or something, and then you take me and I plod around it in 60 seconds. I mean, maybe if you don't know the context, that feels close. I'm not that much worse than them, but when you know the context, this is a massive difference. And they should be earning a lot more from doing this than I should.
Okay, so we want some kind of zero-sum competitive version of these crowdsourced forecasting systems. So two versions that seem to both be out there, but seem at least on the surface to be quite different. So one is a forecasting tournament, which runs much like the standard race tournament we were just talking about. And another one is a prediction market, which is a lot closer to a stock market, but where the stocks are individual events and whether they happen or not. So can you explain both of those differences between those two, the pros and cons of each, and maybe when system designers would prefer one implementation over the other?
Yeah, absolutely. So forecasting competition, exactly what it sounds like, is this idea of there being a single prize and that we're going to crowdsource some forecasts on maybe one event or maybe many events. And using some kind of machinery, we want to award that prize to someone, to a winner. Maybe we could think of them as the best forecaster, although we don't necessarily have to. So this is something that we see a lot in practice. So one nice example is Kaggle competitions. So Kaggle competitions typically are things like labeling, maybe data labeling, and you have to label correctly as many as you can, as many pieces of data. Sometimes they're directly actually about predictions. Those in the US may be familiar with March Madness, the basketball tournament. There's a competition on Kaggle, I think every year, to predict the winners of these games. The Netflix prize. Netflix announced a prize of $1 million to whoever could improve over their recommender algorithm. That, again, can be seen as a prediction, kind of a prediction task with a single monetary prize. And maybe just as one more example, you could even think about hiring. So if you want to hire a forecaster, you know, maybe if we go back to weather, you want to hire a weather forecaster. One way you might do this is look at the records of these forecasters and then choose one to hire. Think of the job being the price. So that's the competitions. Prediction markets, on the other hand, as you see it, are literally a market in prediction, right? It's like instead of stocks, you're trading these contracts, and these contracts pay out contingent on the event occurring. So if you have a prediction market in whether or not it will rain tomorrow, you're trading these contracts, and they're just these, well, literally contracts that pay out a dollar if it rains, or a different type of contract that pays out a dollar if it doesn't. And if you and I, Nick, disagree about the probability of rain, we differ in our subjective values for those contracts. So it's worth it for me to sell you a rain contract and you to sell me a no rain contract, for example. So yeah, these are two kind of the same, they're still crowdsourced forecasting mechanisms, but they elicit these things in quite different ways. And I think you also have pros and cons. So certainly we see these both in different areas. I think one of the nice things about the markets is that they're very easy to use. So when you go and you participate in one of these markets, you only need to, like, you go and you see a price. And that price that you see has some interpretation as a probability. If you see that securities in rain are trading at 80 cents, then you can interpret that as an 80% probability. And you can just decide, well, is that too high or too low? And then you can bear a little bit of money and move the price up or down. So I think that's nice. This price that you see is typically pretty accurate. And to the extent that you trust the efficient markets hypothesis, right, then that this market should be aggregating information, then this will be an accurate price. They're also nice because they're mostly self-financed. I mean, if you can just get two people to bid against each other, you can set up this market. And you don't have to seed it with much or even any money. And people can just come and bid. So that's really nice. Maybe some relative advantages of forecasting competitions. The flip side, you actually get probabilities from people. So to your point earlier, now you can choose how to aggregate these as you wish, but you can take an average or fancy machine learning algorithm and do what you want with this. Maybe you as the center, as the principal, have to finance this competition, but on the flip side there, forecasters don't risk their own money. And this can actually help a lot with legal issues as well.
Yeah, it definitely seems that from a regulatory legal system in the real world, prediction markets have run into a lot more trouble than forecasting competitions. Just quick question. Do you know if there's some sense in which prediction markets and forecasting competitions are the same? I see a lot of results where it's like these two things that you think are different are actually mathematically isomorphic to each other. Is that true of these two things?
Yeah, you do see a lot of results like that, but these ones will, I don't know of any result that says that, and I would be surprised to find one. And the reason why I say that is because of this different input format. So yeah, I'd be surprised.
Okay, so we know forecasting competitions, prediction markets, and as we learned from the discussion on proper scoring rules, there are incentive issues in both of these that a system designer who wants truthful participation from the crowd needs to be mindful of when implementing the rules of these systems, whether that's the forecasting competition runner setting the rules or the market regulator or designer setting the rules of the marketplace. So we're going to be discussing two papers of yours and others that talk about these. So the first one is incentive compatible forecasting competitions, which yeah, we'll be discussing first. So what incentive issue are we trying to solve? As you said, why can't we just use proper scoring rules why can't we just give the prize of the competition to the person with the highest proper scoring rule? Like we would give it to the person running the race who runs the fastest.
Yeah, Absolutely. Maybe just before we get going, these are papers by me and others, and and others is doing a lot of work there. So let me just give a big shout out to my collaborators in this paper, Jens Wachowski, Jen Waltman-Vaughan, Dave Panick, and Andreas Krasser from various institutions around the world. Yeah, so what is the incentive issue? So maybe just to recap again, the goal, when we talk about an incentive issue, what we're wanting to do is make sure that people will report truthfully their probabilities. And this is important, A, because kind of garbage in, garbage out. If we get probabilities that people don't actually believe, we're not crowdsourcing anything. We're just getting a bunch of random numbers. So yeah, why can't we just use proper scoring rules? That's a great question. And in practice, actually, as far as I know, almost always, that is just how it works. That forecasters make predictions on one or more events, and then they get scored by a proper scoring rule. But rather than being paid that score, as is the intention in the strict definition of a proper scoring rule, this get assigned that score in like points, and then the forecaster with the most points is declared the winner. And if you think about it, there's a very simple kind of incentive issue with this. So the idea is that in hindsight, an extreme prediction is always going to look better than a more moderate prediction. So if we have three forecasters and one says that it's going to rain for sure, probability one, and one says it's not going to rain, probability zero. And someone else who's actually looking at the forecast says it's going to rain 70% with the 70% probability. That might be the best forecast in the sense that it best reflects the underlying information. And in expectation, if you repeated this prediction 10 times, maybe you'd get seven days raining and 3 days not raining, and that person would get the highest score. But if you're just going to do that once and you're going to declare one of these forecasters the winner, then you're going to, in hindsight, like one of these extreme predictions. And we see this in real life all the time with these kind of high risk, high reward or extreme out there predictions. And hindsight bias, some of them come true and these people look really good. And that's exactly the problem we want to work against, right? We want to incentivize the 70% and disincentivize the 0 or 1 because that's really nonsense information.
In the context of this forecasting competition, we're interested in producing a ranking of the forecasters. So everyone submits a forecast and then we produce a ranking of how well they did, which we can then use to pay out people. So the person who gets first gets a prize, or like a first, second, third situation, or to then select forecasters for some other task. If you get first in the competition, then someone else says to you, hey, I'll hire you to be my forecaster for these other things. And in that situation, we obviously want the person doing the hiring to be able to look at the ranking and select the best forecaster accurately. So is the idea that if the forecasters are trying to maximize their rank or their chance of being high on the rank, that they can do a kind of high risk, high reward strategy where they extremize their forecast. If they think something's 70%, they say it's 100%. And then that might backfire and they'll be ranked towards the bottom, but they might be ranked towards the top. And that's a better chance of getting to the very top than if they give their true belief, where they'll be ranked somewhere above average, but in the middle.
That's exactly right. It's a boom or bust strategy. And when you're being rewarded for boom more than you're being penalized for bust, then that's a good strategy. We want our incentive structure to align with this idea that we are ranking, where we're ranking people, and people care about their ranking, not about their score. So the fact that the scoring rule is incentive compatible doesn't imply that when you use it in this ranking procedure, that it will still be incentive compatible.
What is the solution that your paper proposes for this incentive problem?
Yeah, so we propose a mechanism that we call ELF, the Event Lotteries Forecaster Selection Mechanism. Bit of a mouthful, but a nice acronym. And it's actually pretty simple. It just uses a formula. One thing that complicates things ever so slightly is that what we actually show is that you cannot hope to get an incentive compatible mechanism. And when I say incentive compatible, just to be clear, a mechanism that does not reward people for lying about their probabilistic belief. So you can't do that with a deterministic mechanism. You're going to have to select your winner randomly in some way. So we can hope for an informed randomness, not just like a uniform coin flip, but we have to use randomization.
And I think in your paper, you have a proof that any deterministic system can't solve this incentive issue. So we're being forced to jump to a randomized system.
That's right. It's not that we couldn't find one. It's that we know that none exists. So you have to go to randomized. So what we do is let's just suppose that we're running a competition just with a single event. So like predicting the weather just on a single day. So roughly speaking, what ELF does is it still does think about scoring rules. These scoring rules are still very helpful in this land. So we're still going to think about giving everyone a score based on their prediction and the realized outcome, did it rain or not. But what we're going to do with their score is a little different. So you can think of ELF as starting with a uniform random choice across the forecasters. So just choose the more equal probability. And then it's going to adjust those probabilities up or down. And it's going to adjust them up or down based on how you as a forecaster did in terms of your proper score relative to the average score. So if you got a higher than average score, your probability of winning will be adjusted up a little bit. It'll be higher than random, higher than uniform, I guess. And if you achieved a lower score than average, then your probability of winning gets adjusted down. And that's basically it. And it's done according to a formula. It's not a particularly complicated formula. It's actually a formula that we borrowed from a different context, from a paper by Kilgore and Gocek. Turns out to work out really nicely in this setting. So yeah, we do that. And when you look at this formula, it's pretty easy to prove that it actually is incentive compatible. So that's nice. And then when you move to multiple events, so if you're predicting the weather on many different days, we can extend our mechanism to work in that setting as well. Probably the more realistic setting. We usually have competitions that last for many predictions. But what we do is we think about breaking those many events down into just blocks of single events. And we run the single event version that I've just described. And we do that on every one of these many events. And then on each of these individual events, we choose a winner according to this kind of randomized formula. And all we do is we just add up who won the most events. And the forecaster that won the most events wins this, like these individual events are like pretend events. And then whoever wins the most of those wins our overall competition.
One alternative solution that people might be thinking of, does that extremizing strategy eventually stop working if the number of predictions goes up? If on any single question, an extremizer will beat a truthful forecaster? But after 1,000, the extremizers will be right some of the time, wrong some of the time. So hopefully we'll get an average score, whereas the truthful and highly accurate forecasters who, when it's 70%, say 70%, shouldn't they still rise to the top? I'm just wondering why this potential solution that's different to the one we're talking about now, why that doesn't work.
Yeah. You know, I think your intuition is spot on that over many events, we get back to this idea where the expectations kind of work out again, and having a higher expected score in every event is going to, in the long run, get you a higher score. So it's true that this incentive issue is most apparent when we just think about one event. It's never going to fully go away, but in the limit, as the number of events gets large, it should become very small, never fully going away. So I do think if you have lots of events and lots of forecasters, and generally, if everything is big, then you're probably fine with the traditional setup. It's when you have a smaller number of events that you might be more worried.
Excellent. And yeah, so that's an idea I originally had. But I think that doesn't actually work as well, because we have to remember the assumption of the different events being independent is really important. So if you're asking someone to predict, say, the results of the 2024 congressional U.S. election, every congressperson in every state, you might think, oh, that's 500 and something individual questions. So on average, like that should be enough to determine. But there's like those are correlated. So if there's a Democratic wave in one state, that should update your belief that the Democratic vote will be higher in another state. So while each individual, there might be a bit of independence, but there'll be a kind of large single factor, which is like how well in general will this party do versus another, that will have a strong determination. So forecasters could still extremize on that large factor. And you still have that problem. And in, I think, a lot of forecasting competitions that we would see in real life, the individual questions that a forecast designer is interested in would still have this correlation. People might be interested in AI timelines of like when certain benchmarks in AI will be reached, and they could put 100 different benchmarks in, but there's still, in the same way, there's still a controlling factor of, in general, how well will AI do that can be extremized over. And yeah, so if you looked at all questions anyone might be interested in, then maybe you get enough independence to be able to do this. But if you even, I think for any single question asker, even if they asked 100 questions, they're probably, their interests are probably correlated enough that those questions will be correlated, if that makes sense. Do you agree with all that? That was a bit of a rant from me.
I do agree with that. Yeah, if you 100 questions, it's quite possible that there's not, yeah, that there's not 2 to 100 bits of information there, but it could be a lot less. Absolutely.
Excellent. And so this, yeah, so this issue of independence, that's something that also comes up in your paper, right? So do you need to assume independence between events?
We do need independence. We actually need something even a little bit stronger. We call it belief independence. Now, is that a problem? I'm not sure. I don't think so. Formally for our model, yeah, it would be a problem if it broke and we wouldn't formally get the guarantees that we have. But if you look at real world competitions, then I think that your rant, as you called it, got to the very nicely to this point. Events are never independent. And in existing forecasting competitions, we treat them as independent by virtue of the fact that we weight them all the same. We might give equal, we don't scale the bias score that we give everyone, that we give the forecasters on any given question by its level of mutual information with the other events. We just say they're not independent, but maybe we took some care to design them in a way that they were almost independent. And we're going to imagine that they are, and then we're going to go ahead. And I don't think that's a problem in practice. And that's exactly the way I feel about our belief independence assumption. What we need, the way it's stronger than just independence of outcomes, is we also need independence of beliefs, as the name suggests. If I learn your belief about event one that we're predicting, this doesn't change my belief about event two. Similarly, learning the outcome of event one shouldn't affect my belief about the outcome of event two.
If I learn your belief about event one, is that allowed to affect my belief about event one?
That's right. We're actually very robust within events. So if we just think about a single event version, we're very robust and we're allowed all sorts of dependencies between my beliefs and anyone else's beliefs. It's just between events that we need this super strong separation. That's a good question.
So one other maybe potential issue or drawback with your method that I noticed was it seems for single events, if you plug some numbers into the formula you use, there seems to be not much difference between the probability of a good forecaster winning the prize versus a bad one. Do you think that's an issue in practice? And is there any way to make the difference in probability between a good forecaster more extreme? Or would that run into other issues?
This is a problem. Even if one forecaster is exactly right, so they predict, they're omniscient, they predict 100% chance of rain and it rains, and every other forecaster is like anti-omniscient, they predict a 0% chance of rain and it rains, so that's the biggest gap we can get, then even the good forecaster there can have a winning probability no higher than 2 over n, where n is the number of forecasters. So if there are 10 forecasters, it's impossible to have a winning probability of more than 20%, even if you're perfect and everyone else is total garbage.
And so because of the forecasting crowdsourcing thing we were talking about earlier, of the wisdom of crowds, we ideally, as designers, want n to be like very large. So if n was 3, that might work, but ideally we want n higher, like 100.
Yeah, you're right. You're right. Typically n will be large, so the winning probability will be small. So you're still going to be close to uniform. And it is unfortunate. The flip side of this is that we actually show in the paper that this, well, we almost show that this is the very best you can do. What we do is we show that for n equal 2. So if you only have 2 forecasters, then you can never be more discriminative. When you only have n equal 2, this 2 over n bound, it doesn't really bite, that gives you 1. But for intermediate cases, you still have this kind of problem of not really discriminating. And we show that you can't do better. And we suspect that for higher n, so when you have more forecasters, you still can't do better, but we weren't able to prove it. I think this really speaks to not so much a defect in the mechanism, but that this is just a super hard problem. You can't, if you just have one event, one outcome, did it rain or not? Signal from noise, right? There's a lot of noise here and it's hard to extract that signal. So it is what it is.
And as listeners to this podcast will eventually realize, this whole literature is filled with negative impossibility results that we wish weren't true. When we have an episode on voting, it's going to be very depressing. Okay, I think I want to now move on to the second paper, Crowdsourced Outcome Determination in Prediction Markets. So we're now thinking of a prediction market format rather than the forecasting competition. What is the incentive issue we are trying to solve now in this paper?
Yeah, again, let me give a shout out to my two co-authors on this one, Sebastian LaHaye and Dave Panic. So yeah, in this one, we wrote this a few years ago now, and we kind of looked at some emerging prediction markets. At the time, they were mostly on the blockchain, but kind of cryptocurrency based. But there are some other ones emerging that I think this is relevant to as well now. And we saw that a lot of these things were really decentralized. So instead of having this traditional setup where you have one platform and you have someone in their offices who is sitting there creating questions and closing questions and arbitrating, we have instead this setup where anyone can create a question and then anyone can close a market. And it's just completely decentralized. And I think that's great. I mean, that's a wonderful development because it lets anyone open a market and get information on whatever they want to. So that's great, but it does open up the possibility for bad actors. So in the worst case, maybe I open up a market and then I trade in that market as well. And I get to close the market. And regardless of what actually happened, I just close the market in such a way that my position realizes and I make a bunch of money. So this is the sort of thing that we were trying to protect against. So we wanted a framework where we could think about these decentralized markets and allow for the possibility of bad actors, but mitigate their effect.
And the solution of, oh, we'll just have everyone have an account and check that the person who participated in the market for a question isn't the same person as the person judging. In the setting, people can make multiple accounts, just like you can have multiple crypto wallets. So we need a solution that is fine with this anonymity situation.
Yeah, that's right. And anonymity, I think, is most salient in the world of cryptocurrencies and blockchains. But even if you think about having to create an account for a particular platform, or you know, sign in with a Twitter or a Google account, this helps a lot. But yeah, it's pretty easy to duplicate that if you want to and pretend to be two different people. So what we came up with, I think, is a nice sequence of chaining some different ideas together. So when you think about making up these questions, they're notorious for being hard to design well. You know, often when you read these things that are designed by professionals, it looks easy. But actually, if you ask a question, even something like, what will be the unemployment rate on September 1st? You have to specify things like, is it the unemployment rate that's reported on September 1st? Or that's later reported to have been the rate on September 1st. And what exact source are you going to be checking? And potentially all sorts of other things that people might not think to specify. So there's often a lot of ambiguity in the outcome, and we wanted to deal with that. And the way we dealt with that is by explicitly allowing outcomes to be non-binary. So what we will have is we're going to have a set of arbiters who all vote on the outcome of this event. So the arbiters vote, if we restrict ourselves to thinking about binary events, yes or no, they all vote yes or no. But then the actual outcome that gets realized is which fraction of these arbiters voted yes. So we'll think about binary kind of events, but we're going to allow non-binary realizations of our market just to allow for this ambiguity.
And so in terms of the payoff, we mentioned earlier that the way these markets work is there'll be an event like who's going to win the presidency, like Trump will win the 2024 presidency. And then that contract, it pays out $1 if Trump does win and zero if they don't. But now, if say 75% of the arbiters think he did win the presidency, then it pays out 75 cents. Is that right?
Exactly. The value of the contract is the fraction of arbiters who vote yes. Yeah, so that was the outcome ambiguity problem. And then the second problem is that we wanted whoever's closing these markets, and in our model, it's the arbiters, we want them to vote according to the information that they believe to be true. Did they see Trump win or did they not see him win? The way that we do that is we draw on this literature that's called pair prediction. And the short version of this is that the arbiters get paid when they make their vote, but they get paid for agreeing with other arbiters. And the idea here is that if you are an arbiter and you read the news that Trump won, then you think it's likely, you know, under the right conditions, that other arbiters also saw that Trump won. So you're going to vote that way and we'll pay you if you agree with others. So it's incentivizing people to arrive at an equilibrium. and again, subject to some conditions, a truthful equilibrium. That's how we incentivize the arbiters to vote truthfully. And then perhaps related to that is this potential conflict of interest, in the sense that if an arbiter has traded in the market, they might actually have an outside incentive to vote non-truthfully. So how we need to combat that is we need to crank up these payments so that the payments that they get from agreeing with their peers is more than their incentives to vote according to their own stake in the market. And the way that we generate this money to crank up that payment and pay them enough is by charging trading fees. And trading fees are a feature that you don't often see in theoretical models, but of course you always see in real life. And so we exploit them in order to make these payments.
One feature I really like about this and the peer prediction aspect is it simultaneously serves to incentivize people to accurately reveal their beliefs, but also it incentivizes people to spend effort investigating the issues. You use this example in your paper in a presidential debate, who told more lies, where it may take several hours of research to figure out the answer. It still incentivizes people to do that. So this system can work with very ambiguous questions that would take the judges or arbiters a lot of time to research. And they're still incentivized to do that because hopefully the other researchers will also be incentivized to come to the correct answer. And then given that, you're also incentivized to come to the correct answer.
Yeah. Since you mentioned effort, I think that's one of the nice things about all of these mechanisms that incentivize truthfulness. You can think of them as incentivizing effort as well, because maybe truthfully you believe something, but you know that if some more effort would have you believe something else, then that would be better to report, right? Than your current mindset. So being better informed is rewarding.
So we have two stages now, right? Where on the first stage, there's the market for the question. Forecasters or traders in this context trade shares, whether they think the event will happen or not. Or I guess now they're trading based on what percentage of the judges after a specific time will report that it happens. And then the second stage, using this peer prediction mechanism, the arbiters report whether they think the event happened or not, and then are rewarded based on how much their answer conforms to the other people's answer. Maybe first I'll ask, with that peer prediction mechanism, I think a lot of people hearing about it for the first time might be worried, or it might sound like you're just being asked to agree with the crowd. So if I investigate a problem and I actually think, wait a minute, everyone's wrong, the unemployment rate is actually X, not Y, in the judging stage, I should go with what I think the average person in the other judges would say. Is that an issue?
Yeah. So this is exactly the starting point of the jumping off point of the peer prediction literature, that if you just pay people $1 to agree with others and $0 if they don't, then they're going to report signals for which the base rate is high. So you have to modify those payments so that you're rewarded more if you agree with someone on an a priori unlikely signal. So how do we take a priori unlikely? We look at the closing price of the market. So if the market closes at 80%, then we say we expect people to come to the opinion that the event happened rather than that it didn't happen. But then if you come to the opinion that it didn't happen and you report that, you'll be paid a lot more if we have 80%. You'll be paid four times as much if you agree on a no than if you had agreed with someone else on a yes. So as long as you believe that you doing the research and coming to the opinion of no makes it more likely, at least a little bit more likely, relative to that 80% baseline, that someone else would have also come to the opinion of no, then things work out.
So in the arbitration stage, you don't just get rewarded for having the same as someone else that you're selected against. You get like extra reward if you and that other person disagree with the closing price of the market. So if the market closes at 90 cents and then you think it didn't happen, then you get even more reward. So like controlling for the price, you should still report your actual belief.
Exactly. If the market closes at 90 and you see a zero, you're probably less likely to match with someone because you think most people are seeing ones, but it's still worth it to you because your payment's higher in that case.
Another interesting thing that I just want to ask you about is there's this update strength parameter that you talk about. And you have this good example of the NBA, if the market's about the NBA versus a president example, which I think I already stole from you earlier. But yeah, can you just explain what's that about and how that affects the different types of events that the market could be predicting?
Yeah. So essentially the idea is that, oh, everything kind of, the mechanism is complex. There are lots of steps, but everything aligns in the same direction, which is that easier kind of better markets should be easier to close. The fees should be lower. Everything should be nicer. So here, the update strength is like our way of measure, how nice of a question, how well-designed of a question was this? So if you have a question like who will win the NBA, then it's inconceivable that two honest people would disagree about that. Like you watch game 7 and the Warriors win, then they won the NBA. Like you, to disagree about that, you'd have to be just in some different universe. So we say that's a high update strength. Because whether you see the Warriors win or not is very highly correlated with whether someone else saw them win. Whereas this presidential example, not so much about an election, but I think in the paper we have this debate example, which candidate told the most lies? If I saw Trump tell the most lies and you saw Biden tell the most lies, this is not inconceivable at all that we would disagree.
And also we wouldn't necessarily expect each other to update. So if you come in thinking one candidate is almost certainly going to tell them more lies, and I think it's the other one, then you don't actually expect me to change my mind that much, probably, in this situation, or at least nowhere near as much as if I said, oh, definitely this team is going to win the NBA. You probably wouldn't expect after that team loses for me to just be like, no, they actually won, to have some weird conspiracy theory where it was all staged or something like that kind of thing. Or like maybe another example would be like what like art is best. So if there's two pictures and we haven't seen them yet, but you're like pretty sure A is going to be better than B. And then after you see it, you do agree that you like picture A better than picture B, but you might expect me to update a little bit, but who knows, like my art preferences could be completely different.
Yeah. And I think the way to get around this and to increase that update strength is to ask a better question, is to ask which piece of artwork will be the most popular according to the poll that is implemented on this day and the results are on this site, right? Like the presidential line, if as long as you point to the right fact checker, then it's not about who lied the most, it's about what did the fact checker say.
Okay, so there are a lot of parameters in this model that all interact with each other. Like you said, it's a bit complicated. Obviously, in a podcast, we're not going to actually sketch out the exact mathematical equations. But can you tell us what you think the realistic values for some of these parameters would be? So like, how much would the trading fee be to get the arbiters to accurately report? How many arbiters would be needed for each market? Would that depend on how many traders or like what the volume of the market is? What are some like realistic numbers for all these quantities?
Yeah, great. So there's a lot to unpack there. One thing you ask is how many arbiters should be used for each market? And I think that's a very natural question. One of the cool things that drops out of our model is that it doesn't actually matter how many arbiters you have. You might think if you have more arbiters, you need more money to pay them, but it actually works out that if you have more arbiters and each one has less effect over the outcome, so the conflict of interest they can have is not so high, so you don't need to pay them as much, and these two things cancel out. So you can have however many arbiters you want. Maybe more arbiters is nice because if you're going to resolve the market as a fraction of the arbiters that have voted yes, you might want to have a high granularity there in terms of what outcomes are possible. But it doesn't really matter.
So you could actually just select one arbiter. And so instead of that fraction issue we talked about.
Yeah, you could have one arbiter. And so in this sense, it generalizes a model where, you know, like one of the new prediction market sites, which I really like, is Manifold Markets. And they, at least with respect to these issues, sounds like they've adopted a bit of a Wild West situation where it's just buyer beware, check the reputation of the market creator. But then you just have the market creator close the market. So you could think of that as the case where there's only one arbiter. And that decision won't affect the sort of fees you need to charge. So in terms of fees, I mean, what do you want? You want fees you want as low as possible. In my opinion, things in the order of kind of 5% are reasonable, maybe a little less. So 2 to 5%, something like that. And then, so once you've decided on roughly a fee level that you want to set, you need to ask, how big can this conflict of interest be? And what I mean by that is, how much money at stake can one of these arbiters have? If you know, if I told you guaranteed you each arbiter had spent only like $100 in each market, then that's not such a big conflict of interest. if they might have spent like thousands of dollars in the market, then it's going to be really hard to make them vote correctly. So there's a trade-off. So what we say is how much we parameterize this by what fraction of the total market volume can be attributed to any one person.
But that's something we can't observe directly, right? Someone could have multiple accounts.
That's right. We can't observe that. We just have to hope. Set some upper bound and hope for the best. So what we find is if you want a trading fee of around 5%, then you can handle markets where you have a single trader contributing around 2% of the total trade, which I think is not bad. It's not great. If you have a small market and a big fish in that market, then I don't have a formal result, but it feels inevitable that if you give them the chance to manipulate the market, they will.
So you said that the number of arbiters doesn't depend on the fee. So the reason why the fee has to be a percentage, it can't just be like fixed, because some markets might be millions of dollars might be traded, in which case for things like who wins the NBA, the amount of money you have to incentivize someone to just go and Google and check is pretty low. But the idea is that it has to be a percentage of the total traded, because we need a person who's selected as an arbiter. We need to make sure that they're not the same as someone who bet on the market outcome, so that their incentive for truthfully reporting, so they get the payment from the peer prediction mechanism, always we want, or as often as possible, to be higher than lying, because they have money on the line in the market stage of the mechanism.
Exactly. They have these competing interests. One is the peer prediction mechanism, which is funded by the fees and pushing them towards a good behavior. And the other is their stake in the market, which is potentially pushing them towards bad behavior. And we set the fees as a percentage. You wouldn't have to, but when you set the fees as a percentage, all that means is that if you have a really big market, you have a lot of money to pay your arbiters, which means that they would have to have a huge stake in the market to manipulate it. So what it's doing is it's just giving you a guarantee that bigger markets will be even more robust, because you have so much money sloshing around to pay the arbiters that they would have had to have a very big stake to overwhelm that.
So one just idea I had, or something I was curious about whether you've looked into, is if instead of using the average of the arbitration, so to get like the 75%, whether using the median could be better, or some other statistic that's like more robust to like changes in the average that could be maybe more resistant to strategic manipulation?
Yeah. So you're right that in some contexts, the median is most resistant to strategic manipulation. I don't think that's the case here, at least not in the sense that we want, because our whole system is based around, we want to use these arbiters, but we don't want any one arbiter to have too big of a say over the outcome. Because if they had a big say over the outcome, that pushes their incentives in the wrong direction, because that can heavily influence the profit that they can get from this market by misreporting. So if you think about the mean, if we have some number of arbiters, let's say it's M, then each arbiter can only change the mean by 1 over M by changing their report from 0 to 1. Whereas if you take the median, if some arbiter changes their report from 0 to 1 and they happen to be the median arbiter, then they change the outcome from 0 all the way up to 1. Right, that can swing their payoff, right? If they had a stake in one in the outcome occurring, then that can swing their payoff by a huge amount, overweighing any kind of payment we could give them. So the mean is good for us because it minimizes the effect that any one arbiter can have on the outcome.
Okay, so final question on this paper. You mentioned one extension could be using a reputation system, which I believe Augur, which is this kind of decentralized prediction market, also uses. Do you know much about how Augur's system works and whether their reputation system also solves this issue? Or should they switch to the system you propose? And maybe also just tell us what we mean by reputation system, like how would that work in practice?
Yeah. Does their reputation system solve this, and should they move to our system? I wouldn't make a confident stand on either of those. As far as I can tell, I believe this is still true, they have a very complex protocol for resolving conflicts, right? And you have to stake some money and lodge a complaint, and eventually the whole system forks and there's a lot of money put up and there's like an escalation involved if you really disagree with how some market has been closed on Augur. Almost certainly you can't prove anything about the system. It's super complicated. It's no doubt took them a long time to design and it's hard to understand. And I have no idea if it works in practice. It may or may not. If they're still using it, then probably it does. Our work is on the other end of that spectrum. It's heavily modeled, but we can prove some guarantees. And I think that there's some nice ideas that could inspire real world systems, like maybe some kind of formal pair prediction mechanism or using fees to fund that. Makes a lot of sense to me. But I guess the main thrust of your question was about reputation. So that's actually how Augur penalizes or keeps the arbiters in line, that they have these reputation coins, which are worth money. And if you don't vote with the majority for some definition of majority, you lose these reputation coins. And then they can weight arbiters with more reputation more highly than those with less reputation. And I think that's a reasonable way to do it. We were talking about Manifold before. And one thing you can do there is, because everyone has to have a Google account to sign to Manifold markets, you can look at, someone creates a market, you can look at their history, see if the markets they've created have been resolved in a reasonable way. So we don't have any kind of notion of reputation in our model. I think it does go a long way. It doesn't go all the way because, as we discussed, these are anonymous environments and you can create a second Google account if you want to. Yeah, I think it helps, but there's still need for some layer of protection on top of that, especially where real money and big amounts of real money are involved.
Okay, so we've talked about both individual papers, one dealing with forecasting competitions, the other dealing with prediction markets. In reading both of these papers to prepare, I naturally had some questions about the interactions between these. So, for example, do you think the peer prediction arbitration mechanism could also be used in a forecasting competition to resolve the questions rather than how I assume it's done now, where the person asking the question resolves the question, like you mentioned how it works on Manifold markets?
Yeah, every forecasting competition setting I know of is centralized. You're right. I don't see why we couldn't use some kind of pair prediction, decentralized arbitration style mechanism to arrive at an outcome there. And I haven't done this, but my guess would be that one could work through the math in our prediction market paper and arrive at very similar results. You have to pay the arbiters, so maybe that comes from that kind of cut. They get some cut of the price for their services. But yeah, I think it would probably work out.
Yeah, so I think that makes sense. I guess maybe if the questioners want to outsource both the forecasting predictions and maybe the answer to the question, if they want both, then maybe this peer prediction could also be useful if they want to know how much progress will AI make in the next 10 years? But in 10 years, they themselves aren't confident in their ability to figure out how much AI progress has made. So they want to outsource both of those. Yeah. So my other question was, can we determine a ranking of the forecaster skill like we wanted to do in the forecast competition just from observing participation in a prediction market? So if I want to hire the best forecaster, but there's only prediction markets around, can I just look at who's made the most money and then hire that person? Or are there issues with that because different participants have different budgets and can put in more or less money, and so that doesn't quite work out?
Yeah, so I think the more or less money would definitely be a big problem. Even you could imagine a more restricted setting though, right? Where you design your own system and you give every trader $100 to start with, or $100 fake dollars. And then you have them trade, and a month later you see who has the most money and you declare them the winner. As long as the participants are actually optimizing for currency, right? If they're trading with real dollars and that's all they care about, then maybe the system works. If they're trading with fake money, or there's like a prize for the winner, or you're going to hire the winner, then you get straight back to this boom or bust problem. If they care more about winning than they do about accruing the, like kind of building up the currency or the score within the system, then they're still going to take risks in order to get to that top spot. So you can do it, but same problems.
Okay, I just have some questions about other incentive problems that I think might come up in prediction market settings. I just wanted your quick thoughts on, with the acknowledgement that this isn't necessarily something you've researched directly. So some of the issues I'm worried about with prediction markets. So one is hedging. For example, let's say I'm an American citizen, and if Trump wins the 2024 election, I want to move to Canada, or like the outcome of the market is bad for me, then that gives me an incentive to bet on the market that Trump will win, so that in the fraction of worlds where Trump wins, I then am richer. And because I might need resources more to finance my Canada trip. So then because of that, I don't end up giving my correct prediction. And if there's a lot of people hedging and maybe the rewards for or the incentives for these hedging is higher, that might affect the market price. So we can't just read the market price as the best probability, like objective probability of the outcome. What do you think about that?
Yeah. So I think what you're describing can be described as people using these markets for insurance purposes. Essentially, by insuring yourself against risk by taking the opposite side. And by doing that, as with all insurance, you pay a cost in expected value, because you're telling me you're not buying because you think the probability is wrong, just because you want to cover your downside risk. And other people are going to sell you that insurance in the sense that they're getting a good deal out of you. As long as there are enough people to sell you that insurance, right, to bring the market back to where it should be, then it's not a problem. If the market is thin and you have people performing this kind of insurance hedging behavior, then maybe we have a problem in terms of information acquisition. But I mostly see this as a positive, right? We can get information and we can allow people to hedge and insure themselves.
Yeah, I definitely agree that like both services are good. I'm just worried about the interactions between them. Ideally, if there was a way where like you report your true probability and you report your utility for both outcomes, and then the market in return gives you both money for being correct and also the insurance. But I think you're right that if the like budgets of the insurance providers is large relative to these hedging people, then the market price shouldn't be affected.
Yeah, that's a nice idea though, about separating these out and being explicit about your beliefs and your preferences. So maybe you should write that paper.
So another issue would be forecasters being incentivized to affect the outcome of an event. If I am a sports player of some kind and I bet on an outcome that I can control, like I can lose a game, I can, yeah, if I'm the favorite, 90% I'm going to win, I bet $1 million on me losing, then I throw the fight and then that affects the outcome. We might still be able to read the price of the market as an accurate prediction. But if that leads to self-fulfilling prophecies or negative effects on the actual outcomes of the world, then that seems like it could be a problem.
Yeah. And this is generally still in this realm of conflict of interest, where essentially you're saying that there's more money to be made from the market, well, not so much more money, more utility, more benefit to be made from the market than there is from the prestige of winning the sports game. And yet that's a problem. There's some really cool work, I don't think our work directly addresses that. There's some cool work by Vince Conitzer, actually my old PhD advisor, with some of his former students, about designing scoring rules that are actually immune to this. So I think this is something that's out there in the literature as well, and that people have thought about and you can at least partially address. But yeah, I think it still comes down to if it's a big enough market, then you have to have something that overwhelms that incentive.
Yeah, definitely. And also like in practice, I guess we just make that illegal. We just call that insider trading. And obviously with the sports example, that's super legal. But yeah, I'll get that reference, that paper from you and link it in the description. A third issue, which I think, again, I've heard people say has happened in practice, is if a forecaster really cares about, they actually just want the price or the prediction of the market to go up for non-monetary reasons. So let's say we're in a situation where there's 20 primary candidates from the Democratic Party to be the next nominee. And I really support one of them who's currently at 0.5% for being the eventual winner. But I think if they get a chance, if they make it to the final five or final three, their arguments are so good that they'll win out and be selected. So maybe then if I bet a ton of money that they will win, and get their percentage to go up from 0.5% to 10% so that they're in the top three or four. That way they get enough attention. People who like look at the market are like, oh, this person has 10%. I should look at their policy platform. That may or may not be like good in that particular situation, but it seems that there'd be issues with, again, the price of the market not being an accurate probability.
Yeah, although arguably it is inaccurate in that to the person who bought that price up, it is an accurate probability.
Yeah,
at least conditioned on getting high enough. Yeah, I think that's a really nice example. And you're not all the way to decision markets where we're explicitly making decisions based on the outcome of a prediction market, but you're part of the way there. And this idea that people have, that the things get very interesting when the market prices have a cyclical effect on the real world, which in turn affect the prices. I don't really have anything smart to say, but I think it's a very interesting question.
Okay, so almost finished. Just one more question. This peer prediction mechanism in general just seems really cool. And I was looking through some of the papers you cite using this that is used in other applications. And I think maybe a lot of people, or at least in the audience of this podcast, I expect, have heard of prediction markets and forecasting competitions. But this might be the first time they've actually heard of this peer prediction mechanism. Are there like other applications you're aware of that you could just, you don't have to describe in detail, but just like mention that you think this type of mechanism could be used for outside of forecasting competitions?
Yeah, absolutely. So we borrowed them for this, but classically what they use for is for eliciting information when you have no kind of verification method afterwards. So with scoring rules and classic forecasting, people make a prediction and then something happens and you can score them against that. Whereas with peer prediction, the idea is that you don't have any realization. And this is why you score them against a peer, like a peer report, because you have nothing else to report to hold them to. So this is classically for things like eliciting reviews. You could imagine if Google wants to pay for restaurant reviews, then they have no way to actually go and verify if you had a positive experience. But, you know, you're more likely to have a positive experience if others have a positive experience. So if they pay you some scaled amount, you do this a little more cleverly, as we've already discussed today. But if they pay you essentially for agreeing with others, if you have a good experience, you think the restaurant's good, so you'll give it a positive rating and you're confident that you're agreeing with others. If you have a bad experience, then you think someone else will as well, and you'll report that. So that's where they were designed for. Also things like crowd workers, right? If you're paying crowd workers to label images for you, this is for offensive content in each of these 1,000 images. You could verify and spot check everyone, but maybe you don't want to do that. By definition, you don't want to spend your own time on that. So you can have 2 crowd workers complete each task, and then you pay them, again, some scaled according to the base rate of whether they agree. So anytime you want to elicit information, but you don't have a way to verify its quality, peer prediction can come in handy. It's a very cool topic, big and continuing literature on this.
It sounds like an impossible problem. Okay, we want to incentivize truthful reports, even though we'll never be able to verify what the thing is. Another cool application I was looking at was peer grading, where in an online class, if it's something like essay writing, where it's a high cost for a teacher or tutor to mark an essay, you have all the people write their essay and then each then give other people's essays to the students. So like you write one essay, but then you mark 5 other people's essays, because obviously marking an essay is almost certainly easier than writing it. So you can do more than one. And then they get maybe 90% of their score comes from the essay writing, but 10% comes from how well they marked an essay. And you use peer grading to score how well they mark it based on how much they agree with other people.
Yeah, I forgot that one. That's a very nice application too.
Okay, so final question. What is the research frontier? What is the upcoming work that either you or some of the co-authors that you know are doing? Can you give us any previews? I know you publish in several areas, but in this particular area of forecasting competitions, prediction markets, what interesting questions do you think people should be researching? Yeah, so maybe either, yeah, what are you working on in particular? Or if someone's interested in this area and, oh, I want to, yeah, work on this, what are some questions you wish someone else were to spend time trying to answer?
Yeah. So I think like with all work, there's a lot of scope for follow-up work. And in general, along the lines of relaxing assumptions. So I can't remember exactly how many times I've told you even today, we didn't look at that, but you could imagine doing this. And you could just imagine building these models ever closer to reality along a lot of dimensions, especially with the markets. This world of decentralized markets, as far as I know, there's been very little follow-up academic work on our paper, and a lot of these things implemented in the real world. Can we either prove something formal about the sort of mechanisms that are being used, or extend the models to get closer to the sorts of things that are being used and still have guarantees would be nice. I think more generally how I feel about a lot of the kind of mechanism design in literature, especially in this space and others, is that it would be really nice to move beyond a lot of the worst case assumptions that we have. So a very worst case analysis, we assume very strong strategic behavior by the agents, things like independence of events as well. So just can we think about how our guarantees decay as we move towards reality? Or maybe they don't even decay. Maybe they get better if our participants are not so strategic minded. So I think anything in that direction would be super cool. And of course, also, I'm very interested in these things being implemented. So in the competition world, we see so many competitions that are just paid by proper scoring rule. And in our paper, we actually point to one example where someone who won a KO competition explicitly points to this kind of boom or bust strategy. So I would just love to see the ELF mechanism or something closer to it be implemented and see how it does.
And there should be an incentive for the designers of these competitions to do that. Like you mentioned, the Netflix had a $1 million prize where they probably got worse result than they would have because they didn't think about that incentive issue. So to the people out there who are designing competitions, like very much you can take this and implement it.
Yeah, absolutely. There are, of course, just to moderate that a tiny bit, I'm mostly on board. There are, of course, the problems we discussed, particularly with the probability of selecting or winning for a good forecaster. One nice thing about the scoring rule selection is that it does select someone with probability one. So you don't have this element of chance that is maybe leaves a bad taste in the mouth for some applications. So I get why people do what they do. But yeah, I'd love to see people explore with different mechanisms. In terms of what I'm doing, I don't really have anything in the pipeline on either of these two topics exactly. Maybe one thing that I'm hoping to get out soon is actually an extended version of an old conference paper that talks about the link between resource allocation problems and prediction problems. So what we do is we take scoring rules and we actually apply them not to prediction, but to resource allocation. We get a lot of very immediate advances by combining the two fields.
Awesome. Thank you so much for talking to us. I very much want to interview you again in the future about some of the other research you do. And yeah, like we said, this is like very cool, very important, very much things that I think there are current people out there who are both either designing forecasting competitions or prediction markets that I think should very much read these papers and try to take insights from them to apply them to get better incentives. Yeah, thank you so much for your time.
Thanks a lot, Nick. It's great chatting to you.